let's do that. Welcome to everyone. Say hello to everyone.
Hello.
That's the whole group, and we're in postmodernism, and we've managed to get into the WLE Centre, and we may get out. Manos is also experiencing some difficulties this week with the new door system, partially installed. Okay, so anyway, there's a songwriter and a singer called Tom Waits, and he's been recording, making music for over many, many years. It doesn't play live very often, so there's an absolute scramble for tickets. And he hardly ever tours, and he's immensely popular and very, very clever, chap. And this is how he announced his US tour of the summer of this year on YouTube. I'm hoping that this works. It worked upstairs.
Looks like the press conference is about to begin.
Calm down. Hold your horses, baby. We'll get to all your horses. What? I dated your mother? Oh, my God. How is your mother? Who plans the tours? Well, I'm glad you asked that. Frankly, there's absolutely nothing that's random about it. If you think about it, from the beginning of time, we've all looked to the night sky for guidance and meaning. I mean, how did the Magi find the Christ child in the manger? How indeed? And when we're all lost, what do? We look up to the night sky. Indulge me. As I connect the towns here, and our route across the great Southwest, starting with Phoenix, Arizona, you'll see a pattern starting to emerge. And you'll notice it has a corresponding night constellation. The constellation Hydra. Now, as you watch over here, the first letter of each town forms what we call an acronym. Pescajumba. PEHDTSCKJMBA. Pescajumba. Now, let's unlock this further. Come with me. People. Envy. Happiness. Dogs, though. Sense. Courage. Knowing jubilation means better. Assets. Pretty profound. Let's just remember the guiding word of the summer tour. Pescajumba. Pescajumba. Say it with me. Pescajumba. Beautiful.
Going to Europe.
It's the constellation Aradnus. It's known for its wildly veering path that'll be controlling and dictating our route from Spain to Dublin. I'll be giving you more details as they emerge. Are there any more questions? Am I coming? No, actually, I'm going. Say hi to your mother.
So what on earth was that?
Pescajumba.
A simulacrum of a press conference. Okay. obviously, each year, trying to find something that tries to represent the sort of starting points for thinking about things that set out to be deliberately postmodern. each year something comes up, and this year it was that, and I keep playing it, and every time the camera pulls away. And also there's a temptation to get towards the end of YouTube clips and just leave it and go on to the next one. But you have to see it, that one out to its natural conclusion. So it's a simulation of a press conference. Any other reactions to it? Have you ever seen the like? Okay. And unfortunately, he only played on the mainland in Edinburgh, and tickets were £195 apiece. So I'm afraid they don't pay me enough to go and investigate Tom Waits at that level. But I was fortunate enough to see him play live many, many years ago. So I count myself one of the lucky ones. Anybody seen him play live? Okay, it's an experience. It really is an experience in itself. Okay, so this is where we are at, and we're in the section on postmodernism. And if you do any kind of a Google search on postmodernism, you come out with an absolute tag cloud's worth of definitions, of examples. You'll hear words and critics and cultural theorists that you've discussed under many other different chapter headings, all mentioned as being postmodern. And at the heart of it, there's an idea, and the idea is proposed by one or two originators of the term, but that the term has been run away with rampantly by all sorts of cultural theorists and apologists for all sorts of activity in the popular cultural domain. So some of the things that you'll encounter, this is a definition from this book that Postmodernism in Educational Theory, Education and the Politics of Human Resistance. And this is a postmodern cop, and it's another joke, and you often get jokey definitions of postmodernism. But for postmodernists, the world is fragmented, history is ended, all struggles are local and particularistic. And one of the things about this sort of joke is that it's meant to pull you up short and to make you think about what you're thinking about. So in the previous example, you think about all the other press conferences, maybe, that you've seen to announce something like a tour. Are they all staged in that way, or is it really, you know, is it real or imaginary? So this one is about you're standing on my neck, one point of view, but one could also say that you're trying to trip me with your neck. You see in the postmodern condition, this is the postmodern cop speaking in the third frame here, we create our own reality based upon our internalized preconceptions. Since there is no longer one objective truth, we are free to create our own truth. So you see, there is no right and wrong, just an infinite number of equally valid stories. But you're still standing on my neck. You never went to college, did you? So there is a response of the postmodern cop. Then you get ones that are, they're obviously jokes, but they're designed to inspire some kind of deeper engagement with the theory. This particular one is an image from of modernism, modernist art. We will come back to what modernism might mean when we talk about what postmodernism might mean as well. So postmodernism explained, this is modernism, and this is a post. Simple, really. Okay. And the sometimes these jokes have more depth than they at first seem. But a lot of people who fight shy of critical theory altogether, or assume that the whole thing is a sham, is a simulacrum of what theory is anyway, they don't draw any comfort from this kind of thing. They just think it's yet another instance of somebody being clever. And there is a terrific backlash against academia on the web, and you'll notice this, you'll see this, there's lots of criticism from it. Postmodernity suggests that none of the stories that you've previously been told are true, so sometimes postmodernity is allied with atheism. And so therefore you have a lot of evangelical Christian sites and sites from other faiths attacking postmodernists and attacking postmodern theory across the web, and some kind of fight back against that. Because the logical extent of postmodernism is that there are no beliefs and there's nothing that we can trust anymore, and there are no truths beyond the fact that everything is saleable. And it turns on an economic argument as well as a philosophical one. Okay, one more, I think. Unless I just went on and on adding them. Postmodern crap cop. Okay, I'll confess, I can't take any more of this indeterministic postmodern rationalism. I've never felt so completely lost. When the good cop, bad cop routine no longer gets results, you know who to call. Postmodern crap cop. So that's another one there. So, and while we're at it, just share with you another site. Does anybody know the Communications from Elsewhere website? Okay. This is perhaps the ultimate academic resource for cultural theory, Communications from Elsewhere. And in case your eyesight is not that good, that doesn't say porno at the top there, it says POMO for postmodern. See, if my eyesight's not that good, and I can see that it looks a bit strange. But it's www.elsewhere.org/POMO, P-O-M-O. And you'll see that this particular article here is actually a pre-cultural discourse in the works of Tarantino, The Broken Door. It's written by Andreas Q. Hamburger of the Department of Ontology, Carnegie Mellon University, and Y. Stephen Brophy, Department of Politics, Stanford. Okay, and just read the first paragraph. Society is fundamentally dead, says Bataille. In a sense, Tilton holds that we have to choose between Foucaultist power relations and subdialectic theory. Baudrillard suggests the use of pre-cultural discourse to deconstruct capitalism. And as you read on down and you start to make notes from this and you chop out bits that you might want to use in an essay, as you read further down the page, maybe you begin to wonder whether this in itself is a simulacrum of an academic. Come to what simulacrum means a little bit later on. Oh, and when you get to the bottom, the essay you have just seen is completely meaningless and was randomly generated by the postmodernism generator. To generate another essay, follow this link. Click. And what do we have now? The Iron Sky, a Bataillist powerful communication and the subtextual paradigm of consensus. This time it's written by Zed John Prynne of the Department of Literature and Stefan H.A. Abian. And we are in the realms of Burroughs and Debordist Image, section one, and so on and so on and so forth. So, Communications from Elsewhere is obviously a satirical look at the whole world of postmodern, and it was written by a computer scientist using something called the Dada engine. But that's one to bedazzle you with. I mean, when I first looked at it, there were a couple of paragraphs there that I thought, well, that's an interesting way of putting things. So maybe you would agree with that, but it's one to share. Okay, so I'll post that. I won't be able to hoodwink the part-timers because it's on the podcast, but maybe next year I'll post that one the previous week. We'll see where we go. Don't quote from that in your assignments, please. We do know. Communications from Elsewhere. Okay, so let's dig a little bit deeper into where this term comes from. So it's described as being in a linear, literal sense after modernism. And modernism is a little bit harder to define, actually, than postmodernism, perhaps. But modernism often refers to the state of the arts and literature and poetics from about the end of the 19th century into the early 20th century. So we're talking about writers such as T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, those kinds of writers, and painters would possibly be Picasso and Matisse and all of those others. And what modernism attempted to do was to try to get to something that was to resurrect some idea of that there being a sort of a truth or a beauty at the heart of the detritus that was around. So you've got the Wasteland by T.S. Eliot, which brings in popular cultural references alongside ancient texts and makes a collage of them in the name of a modernist movement, in the name of a modern movement that rejected previous poetical ideas. So that what he's trying to say is that you can shape it into a rational vision of an eternal and absolute truth which you can reveal in the different cultural quotations that you make. And trying to get from the world, the post-industrial world and the post-colonial world, an idea of a unitary self at the heart of all of this. And it kind of mirrors the rise of capitalism, totalitarianism, the nation state and so forth, this is absolutist idea that there is this truth and universal truth in art. But what this leads to is a pulling away from absolute representations that were previously, you know, the romantic notions of representation. And what it leads to is a kind of cultural elitism where you need to be in on the code of modernism to understand it. And it pulls away from popular culture years later, so that a poem might not just be about a tree, but it might be about what the tree represents in terms of some kind of universal truth by reference to other times that trees have been referenced and so forth. And you require some understanding of high art. And modernism begins to shift those expressions of art into the realm of the art gallery and into the realm of the cultural elite. So that after modernism, there comes this challenge, this riposte to that, and this idea that actually, no, we need to break these barriers back down again. These things go around in cycles. And so we need to go back towards a naturalistic representation and just have the aesthetic of the beautiful, as it says here, and so forth. So, but for what postmodernism seeks to do is to say that that's actually, that there is a further fracturing, a further loosening of the signifier and the signified bond, so that nothing, unless you've actually placed it there, nothing necessarily means what it seems. And the meanings that you try to take from something, a text, are all necessarily shifting. It's quite close to the ideas that Derrida had, and this is why Derrida's often quoted in terms of postmodernism, which is this idea that meaning is eternally deferred. But in postmodernism, all meanings are subject to the person who's actually reading them, but they're also subject to purchase and to accretion into other texts. So you get texts talking to each other. You get high art talking to low art, and you get what was previously understood to be high art can be subsumed within popular culture, and popular art can be subsumed within high culture. So you lose the reference to any particular truth, which is what modernists were looking for. You lose that absolute sense of there being a truth in the art. There is also the idea that it begins not to matter whether you have had contact with anything original. The original work of art begins to lose its aura, if you like. And in this sense, postmodernism, you find an affinity with the writers that we've already looked at. If you think, who am I thinking of when I'm talking about originals and copies?
Walter Benjamin?
Yeah, Walter Benjamin's article on the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction. So these are other ideas then, these are other words that get thrown around. Depthlessness, simulacrum, which I will come back to. The collapse of the elite popular divide. A loss of history. A relativizing of cultural value. Multiple identities. And something that Story refers to as the pick and mix aesthetic. A politicization of the aesthetic and the abandonment of grand narratives, along with the fact that there is no kind of truth, no one kind of single truth, comes this idea that all meta-narratives which attempt to explain the human condition and our purpose are essentially fractured, that those meta-narratives can't really exist. Okay? And the person who first wrote about that would have been this guy, Jean-François Lyotard. And he's credited as being the first of the main writers about postmodernism. He was writing about science, and he talked about a crisis of truth for science in the academy. I didn't get time to sort out. I was going to look for a really good quotation in here, but I'm not going to be able to find it. Okay, you can read about Lyotard in chapter 8, pages 130-133 on there. So he was talking about scientific knowledge as being a kind of discourse and a game played with language, and speaking about this thing called the mercantilization of knowledge. Can you think of an example, if he's writing about science, and he really did decide to pick on something that you would assume to be true, like a true story, can you think of any contemporary narratives of science that when you unpick them, you struggle to understand what's going on with those contemporary kind of narratives? Is there anything that you know of in within the last 5 or 10 years, perhaps? Quantum physics. Okay. And what massive experiment is going on?
The Big Bang.
Yeah. Okay. So the Hadron Collider. Okay. So can anyone explain that to me? I'm impressed that you're having a go, Neela. That's very good. That's more than I could do. Okay. So I suppose what we're saying here is that even the truth and the attempt to communicate the scientific absolute truth about something descends into this this series of language games. Now, if you think about the way the world was understood, with the Earth at the centre, and beautiful old woodcuts and engravings of the machinery of the stars, with the stars being wound around in a giant wheel. And we can, from our rationalist perspective, and the Enlightenment could look down on that and admit that that was, you know, that's rather a foolish way of thinking about it, because the Earth goes around the sun. And these are the things that we learned in school, certainly when I was at school a really long time ago. That's the sorts of things that we were taught. And also, I did physics for a little while, up as far as I could, took it as far as I could, and then jumped ship. You know, that there's such things as this is actually made up of really small things inside somehow. They're molecules, and the molecules themselves are made up of atoms, and inside an atom there's a nucleus. And now I'm beginning to push towards the boundaries of my understanding of it. So there's a nucleus, and then there's little things inside there. And often what happens is that the language games that start to appear around this will involve making some kinds of analogies to get to the truth, such as if you imagine the concert hall in London, the Royal Albert Hall, there's a, what's the famous thing? There's a tennis ball at the middle of the Albert Hall, and then an electron would be like a grain of salt spinning around the ceiling. That's the distance, that's the space inside the atom. What must that space inside the atom be full of? How does that relate to the beginning of the world? Pretty soon, we're back to talking about quarks and other subatomic particles and so on, all of which are given names like strangeness, charm, beauty. Hang on a minute. We're back to the medieval whirring of the mechanics, the beautiful kind of whirring of the mechanics and the fairy creatures making the stars shine, in a way. So scientific knowledge is a kind of discourse, actually. It's endlessly looking for meaning, and the meaning itself is deferred, as we know, through all these papers and so forth. There was a fantastic spoof on the front of the Guardian newspaper at the time of the Collider, and I don't have a copy of the scan with me, I wish I had, which was a diagram that purported to explain what the Hadron Collider was. And you looked at it and you thought, that's interesting. But the closer you looked at it, you realised it was actually meaningless. It was the same as the postmodern generator. It just had number 3, Bernard, written there. I'm stuck, I don't understand this. Big button. And it was just full of... But it was from a distance. It looked like a scientific explanation. So there is a crisis of truth for science in the academy. Everything is... kind of bought and sold. I wonder why they're doing the Hadron Collider experiment. What is that? Why are they doing the Hadron Collider experiment? That's where this phrase, the mercantilization of knowledge. I'm trying to apply this to a modern setting. The mercantilization of knowledge. Okay, so the true goal of the system, he reasoned, was it programs itself like a computer, optimization of the global relationship between input and output. In other words, performativity measures. So the reason why they're doing the Hadron Collider experiment is actually not that far below the surface, perhaps. And they end up talking in these magical scientific terms that we don't understand anymore. I don't understand them. Anybody else understand subatomic physics that can explain it? Okay. The most famous exponent of postmodernism, then, as you probably know, is the writer Jean Baudrillard. And what he intended to show was a partly socio-economic argument, which is to say that the postmodern condition, the postmodern philosophy, arises in Western industrial societies because not so much physical material is produced anymore, but lots of information is. And information is malleable and depends on the referents at the time in order for its meaning to be understood. But the meaning itself continually shifts and can be bought and sold. Okay? So he was moving from modernity and the search for the real below the surface. He started off with Marx and so forth. And in the end, his writing abandons this idea that there is a real even to be described. And he came up with this concept of the simulacrum. Have you heard of that before? I mean, it's actually become part of popular cultural analysis. People talk about a simulacrum in the same way as they talk about being postmodernist without perhaps ever having encountered anything by Baudrillard or Lyotard or any of the others. You say, it's a postmodern situation, it's a postmodern condition. That exhibition is very postmodern. The Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, that's a postmodern building. So has anybody come across Baudrillard before? Have you heard of him? I mean, he was quite a famous person. I mean, we talked a little bit in the post-structuralist session about the way in which Derrida performed the intellectual. Well, in a way, Baudrillard performs being an intellectual as well, but performs it in a sense that where he was often invited onto shows to explain what he meant by some of his stranger pronouncements. Perhaps you're aware of his contribution in the early 90s when the first Gulf War was. Have you heard of this? Does anybody know what I'm talking about? Go on. He produced a series of three essays at the time of the first Gulf War, not the second. So the one that happened in or around 1991, he said the Gulf War will not take place. That was a one position statement. And then he said the Gulf War is not taking place, and his final, the Gulf War did not take place. This is obviously quite an outrageous statement. And if you were the relative of someone who suffered in that conflict, you might feel outraged. But the intention was to provoke an intellectual debate about the nature of modern representation of events within its own popular culture system. So the way in which the Gulf War was represented was very different to the ways in which, well, different to the, not very different, but different to the ways in which other wars had been represented. Does anybody know what he was what he was actually talking about with this representation? This, go on, sorry.
Yeah, you could watch the bombings at 8 o'clock, at 10 o'clock. If you miss it, you can watch the rerun. The next day was pretty much like a series.
You could watch it, but you could watch it at a distance, and it certainly. I remember the Falklands conflict 10 years before, which was a televised conflict as well, but there were battle scenes in that. There were no battle scenes, because there aren't really battles anymore in the way that there used to be battles during wars. And that's because so much of what happens in a war, in a conflict now, that actually decides anything, is there's the policing, as we see in Iraq and Afghanistan now. Afterwards, there's the policing and the scrapping and the hand-to-hand fighting in streets, but the major warfare is conducted from the air. And what we saw on our TV screens in 1990-91 was it was the era of the smart bomb, if you remember. So if you aimed your crosshair carefully enough on a particular group of buildings and released it at a certain height, it would find the target. No one would get hurt, really. No civilians would get hurt on either side, but the military target would be taken out. This language was used, and this language, the language of video gaming was used, and I think that what he was saying was that it had turned into a simulacrum, if you like, of a war, a kind of a version of a war that was fought on screen as though it were a game. And we kind of got used to this idea that, that everything was a cockpit view of a war, and we lost sight of what was happening. There were some shocking incidents in that war of where the smart bombs were not so smart, and large numbers of people were killed on the ground, of course. But in a way, what Baudrillard is saying there, it's easy to say that in a way, for us, we go about our normal business and something is happening on the news that we can tune into and out of, which to us is hyper-real. It's not real to us in any meaningful sense of the word. It's just it looks a bit like a video game, quite a tidy conflict, whereas earlier conflicts were rather messy. This is a kind of a step back from the messy reality of what happens on the ground, and it was fought like a video game. We saw a little bit of that in the second Gulf War as well, where we were told that the way to win the war was to go in straight away with what they called shock and awe. And again, a lot of the early attacks on Baghdad were shown as being from the air. We saw them at a distance from some hotel quite a way away, and we didn't see much of what was happening on the ground, but we had that hyper-real sense of obviously not too many people are going to get hurt in this, and it'll mainly be military targets. It's going to be quite a tidy sort of conflict. So for Baudrillard, he's achieved this kind of guru status. And one of the things that he's written about is, of course, Disneyland, which is... this is the concept of the simulacrum. And he talks about a simulacrum as being... Let me get the right definition for you here. A simulacrum is an identical copy without an original. Yeah, I'll say that again. A simulacrum is an identical copy without an original. Something that you think you might have seen or experienced that looks a bit like it might have been something once that is now something else again. It's like a simulacrum of a real thing. Where would there be a castle like that? Maybe in Bavaria, actually. Maybe. But when you went to Disneyland, I mean, you get the sorts of things where children compare experiences. If they've been there, they say this is like Disneyland. If they're in a park, they say this is a bit like Disneyland. But Disneyland was intended to represent a park and reconstruct a park in the first place. So you begin to get the sense that there is something in this of the modern condition, this postmodernism idea that we are experiencing life at one remove, and our experience of popular culture often is at one remove. Things have become so self-referential. I was watching, I sort of put my head around the front room door, and the kids, just before they went off to school, were watching Freshly Squeezed on Channel 4, and the two boy pop presenters were having a discussion in which they were being incredibly postmodern, and I wish I'd managed to capture it for you. If I do succeed, I think I grabbed it, but because I grabbed the whole thing, I have to go and find it again, and I'll post it online for you. But the essence of the conversation was, we just interviewed these, they'd interviewed the Stereophonics, perhaps the dullest people to ever sit on an interview couch. How's it going? Oh, great. Enjoy the tour. What was the best thing about the tour? Well, we opened for U2. Okay, what was that like? It was awesome. The party was amazing. There was really lots of people there. Okay. And then they moved along quickly, and then they had a little conversation between the pair of them afterwards where they agreed that most pop stars were rubbish, but that their jobs depended on it. They had this wonderful dialogue, and then they said, well, maybe you could come and do better, and then we can disrespect you as well. And it was addressed to the camera. Maybe you can come into the sort of simulacrum and pretend to be a pop star as well. So that once you start to notice these things, it's all over the media. So he said that the simulacrum or the simulacra were produced from miniaturized units from matrices, memory banks, and command models. And with these, it can be reproduced an indefinite number of times. So for popular culture, that means that there are always reference points to a castle, some sunshine, a rainbow, some stars. There are miniaturized, there are little bits of units that you can assemble into various simulacra, and people will sort of know what you mean and what you talk about. And I've got another example to show you of how this can be perhaps played with a little bit. Anybody watch Flight of the Conchords?
Yeah.
Okay. So you may not know exactly what they're parodying in this, but maybe you do. So this is the scene where these two... Anybody not know Flight of the Conchords? Okay. These two are New Zealanders, and in the TV show they describe themselves as the fourth best digifolk parodists in New Zealand. So they're a pop group, these two, and they're trying to make it, and they live in New York City, and they have all these different adventures, etc., etc., and it usually involves trying to meet women and trying to sell their music, and they deal with a manager who's absolutely awful, this guy called Murray, who can't manage at all. And so this guy really likes the look of these two women that work in a French cafe, and so in this scene he's persuaded Brett to go into the cafe with him and order a croissant from the two women that work there. So here we go, let's do the film screening thing.
Je voudrais un croissant.
What?
Je voudrais un croissant, je suis enchanté. Où est la bibliothèque? Voilà mon passeport. Ah, j'arrête de partir. Baguette. Oh, baguette.
Never seen it, then you really should. Okay. So to be postmodern about that, how would we go about it? If we were to think about some of the issues that we've raised about quotation and copies and originals and simulacra, and think about it in terms of what would you say about that? Why is that funny? What are they getting at? What sorts of references are being made here? And how is it postmodernist, if you think it is? Or you can say that has nothing to do with postmodernism. What do you think? Okay. Okay, making fun of. So it's is it being stereotypical, or is it making fun of stereotypes? It is. Are you able to pull away from it a little bit and laugh in both senses? Are you able to?
Yeah.
Could you? Yeah. Okay. Yes. What did it look like when it changed colour? What did it look like? Yes, with the deliberate distortion of the camera angle as well, things were on a jaunty kind of a tilt, and the colour was hyperreal, to use another postmodern word. It was heightened from reality. Anything else about it that you noticed? Anybody teach languages? It's like a language teaching video, isn't it, in places? It's like the... And maintenant, le voyage dans le supermarché. Now, the voyage in the supermarket.
Yeah,
where you get these... The decontextualized words that you get in some... or maybe you don't get it in language teaching now, but it's certainly when I was learning languages, one had these dreadfully artificial situations. And they even...
No.
Okay, I'm glad to hear it. No, I'm pleased to hear it, because the stops in the conversation in the park, doesn't he, to say, oh, we're having a conversation in the park. So again, it pulls away. I think this is really to get across the idea. It's when you're able to pull away from something and see it for what it is. It's like a web of copies of original things, slightly parodied. I mean, parody is very close. Parody is a good example, in a way. But it depends on you knowing what some of the reference points are. Maybe you had that kind of language teaching. It doesn't exist now, but you might have had that kind of language teaching in the past. They pick something off a shelf. They happen to be going shopping. So there's all the different nouns that you have to learn. The pamplemousse, ananas, beurre, jus d'orange. You have to learn them. Go on. Exactly. It is a simulacrum, because it's a copy without an original. It's very much a copy without an original. Incidentally, that particular clip, and many others that they make, is responsible for a whole series of further videos. This one is filmed in Second Life. It's the same sketch, but with Second Life. There's a really peculiar thing there, which is basically an insulting, xenophobic, and potentially racist thing about French people there. Don't watch that one. And then the third one along is a glove puppet version of the same thing, done by somebody who'd been challenged by their sister to do it. And so there's some great things in here. And you can, in every episode, there's 12 episodes that exist of this, but in every single episode there's some pastiche, some parody that depends on you being able to pull your own sense of what's happening on screen away, and to remember all sorts of quotations which are not quite right from things. I don't remember an original of a language teaching video like that, but I know I have the sense of it being extant somewhere. If I go to Disneyland, unless I've been to Bavaria, I haven't seen a castle that looks even slightly like that, much less know what's in there, other than it's been, of course, in a movie. And so, of course, Baudrillard writes about film as well, and so does John Story. He says it make no sense for someone having seen The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind in Newcastle to be told by someone having seen the film in Shanghai or Berlin that they'd seen the original. These are copies without originals. If you think about the way that movies are made now, the most recent Oscar winner last year, No Country for Old Men, was constructed entirely in a simulacrum of an editing studio. It was made in Final Cut Pro. So the editing software on screen is a simulacrum of a real editing suite. It's just an arrangement of pixels on light. It isn't a pair of scissors. It isn't a tape. It's not a studio. It's something that's been done with programming language on the screen to look like that. And so the copies of No Country for Old Men, where are they? Where is the original? These are just ways in which you can bring it into a discussion of popular culture. Saying that the reel is produced from miniaturized units and so forth here. There's a response to all of this from the hardliner, I suppose. Not hardline, maybe that's a bit harsh, but Frederick Jameson, writing, an American postmodernist critic, attempts to say there's more to this than meets the eye. It's not enough to throw your hands up in the air and say everything has become a web of quotations and simulacra. What you need to do is to have some steel in the argument and to sort of examine what is actually going on with this, what politically is behind the scenes to all of this. So in a way, Jameson laments the fact that postmodernist writing does break down the elite and popular distinction. And he echoes in his writing the Frankfurt School, if we go back as far as that. And he points to, there's a quotation on page 137 of the story Reader. In postmodernism and consumer society, Jameson points to the erosion of the older distinction between high culture and so-called mass or popular culture. This is perhaps the most distressing development of all from an academic standpoint, which has traditionally had a vested interest in preserving a realm of higher elite culture against the surrounding environment of philistinism, of schlock and kitsch, of TV series and Reader's Digest culture, and in transmitting difficult and complex skills of reading, listening and seeing to its initiates. And in a classic piece of Frankfurt School rhetoric, he writes of the older kinds of folk and genuinely popular culture which flourished when the older social classes of a peasantry and an urban artisanate still existed, and which from the mid-19th century on have gradually been colonised and extinguished by commodification and the market system. So it's the expansion of the commodity through multinational corporatism. And he says, why does this lead to this emptiness at the heart of our culture? He writes about this loss of the past and the future, the intensification of the present, and that there is a commodification of the aesthetic. There is a reason for this, and that is that more things need to be bought and more things need to be sold, and more things need to be up for grabs and constructed for sale out of the simulacra, I guess. But that's what lies behind it. It's not enough just to say that this is happening, or to observe from the sidelines that popular culture is moving this way. But you need to have some kind of political argument around it. And that's what Jameson's writing about. Did anybody do Jameson as their big book? We had somebody last year who did Jameson as their big book. Yeah. Culture no longer masks capitalism, it has become capitalism. So here's what he says about architecture. Logically enough, stage itself as a kind of aesthetic populism and so forth. And there's an example there that one of the things that happens if you Google postmodernism, and particularly in reference to architecture, is you get images like this. This is a strange simulacrum of houses plonked down into a place, into a space. We may ultimately wish to evaluate this populist rhetoric. It has at least the merit of drawing our attention to one fundamental feature of all the postmodernisms enumerated, namely the effacement in them of the older, essentially high modernist frontier between high culture and so-called mass or commercial culture, so that the boundaries are completely blurred, but that there might be reasons for this. So here's an example on the bottom left there of the way in which popular culture references itself continuously. Can you see what that is? Yeah. And what is it, in fact? This is something that you see, if you think in a postmodernist way about a lot of the way that commodities are presented to you, you start to think how one form elides into another as well, and that the references go across genres. But what's actually going on with that image there? It's a book. But is it a book? The whole thing's supposed to look like a book. Why?
Pulp Fiction used to be the name that this magazine is about, Grant and Stanford.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, hang on a sec. I've got it a bit bigger here somewhere. You recognize it now? Yes.
You had the prize there.
Yeah, and in small writing there is the name of the author of this, which you couldn't really see in that. Sorry, that wasn't fair to show you the picture in that way, but by Quentin Tarantino. And that's Uma Thurman, isn't it? So this is the movie. But the... Yeah, absolutely. There are many, many ways in which popular culture attempts to continually reference itself and the older forms in making the older forms new. One of the things that in the old days, old people like me, used to listen to this fantastic DJ who sadly passed away before his time in 2004, John Peel, who was used to just play all the kinds of music that nobody else would play, really, all the stuff that you really liked. So it kind of noise metal-y things and techno-y things and reggae and punk and nothing that would fit into the rest of the schedule. And we used to, and I'm sure if anybody else had this, access to this technology, make up mixes of these things on cassette tapes. Remember cassette tapes? And swap them around. Or you'd give a mixtape to someone that you particularly liked and say, I hope you like this. Now, you just sort of select tracks in iTunes and 15, make a CD, print the cover up. There you go. It's somehow lost this magic of, and you had to think about how the first side would end and then you'd flip over and then you'd listen to the... Anyway, so there's a whole site built on this kind of nostalgia and reference point back to tapes, and when you do actually...
Well, at the age of 37 and weighing just a little bit over 13 stone...
It goes round, like the cassette tapes used to.
I'm not about to dress up as a punk or change my hairstyle or anything, unlike one or two media people who seem to be trying to affect the lifestyle and the appearance of punkdom. But I'm very grateful to the bands and people who make the music, or most of them anyway, for the excitement and heated debate and general bewilderment they brought back to the rock scene.
Okay, that was what listening to his show was like. Really. And making a recording of it and passing it on to somebody else the next day. Oh, excuse me. Right. nostalgia. But... So the things that we consume now, like that site and so forth, and like Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, they depend on you knowing that, and they depend on you referencing that. Even though you, like in Fudefafa, you might never have read a Pulp Fiction novel. And that isn't a Pulp Fiction novel, but it's a simulacrum of one. It's a copy without an original. So this is... So you could make that case. You could make that case. Go on. Yeah.
Yes, but it's really not without an original. There are originals. It would be like kind of playing on the original. Of these kind of
magazines. Yeah. But the point is that it's referencing what your shared cultural memory of there having been archetypes, I guess you could call them. But that even if you hadn't picked one up, you might have passed a stall that was selling them at the South Bank or in a second-hand bookstore or something. You might have seen those kind of frayed spines of these books. And you might not have bought one, but you might have an idea of what might be in there. And so the reference point depends on you knowing that. He also made some movies which are called Grindhouse movies, didn't he? And he made Kill Bill. And it's possible to meet people who will talk to you about Grindhouse without knowing what that means, but they would say, oh, a Grindhouse. Yeah, it was a Grindhouse movie I saw the other night. Yep.
For instance, if we take something in the all these elements of like blood and everywhere and very nonsensical things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Okay.
So this is not a this is like putting it frame by frame of the same thing. So is it just like the cover version?
That's a really difficult question, but it's a good one. Yes, because of course Gus Van Sant took every single shot and exactly replicated it, didn't he? Allegedly, anyway. I don't know if he did or he didn't. Really? Okay. I've not seen Gus Van Sant's version, I must say. I haven't seen that. No, I think that's what you're saying. It's not a simulacrum. But what about his movie Elephant? Now that's an... have you seen Elephant? That's what it might be like to be inside one of the high school shooting. Maybe. And that depends on your knowledge of schools and guns and media and your own the building blocks that you have in your own imagination to join it up to watch that movie to gain it. So that's maybe a simulacrum. That very interesting, that case of Psycho. I need to think about that. This is what Jameson is saying is that the grade B Hollywood film is so-called paraliterature, with its airport paperback categories of gothic and romance. Materials are no longer simply quote. It's not as simple as quotation, but incorporate into their very substance. Because I accept in the example that you've quoted, they're not literal quotations from things, but they absorb something of original elements to make this simulacrum, which is an original without a copy. Yeah. Okay. So here are some arguments against postmodern. Sorry.
There's something strange because postmodernism tends to look at these things, but they have already existed.
Yeah.
Don Quixote.
Yes.
Don Quixote is a postmodern piece, no?
Yeah. Yeah, because there are, and I was just coming onto that, and you'll see you anticipated the slide here, it's a very, very good point. No, it's a good point. Because whereas it's essentially portrayed as a modern idea, it's not necessarily a modern idea to play with the notions that people have and the concepts that they have in this way, and to make things which appear to be postmodern and full of pastiche has been a feature of some playful previous production, cultural production, like Don Quixote. Go on. And?
It's hybrid.
A hybrid?
Yeah, hybrid.
Okay.
Is it the same?
It could be, except a hybrid could be made actually literally out of parts of something else. But if the parts themselves are quotations or simulated versions of something else and then put together, then it's even more...
So it's further stage?
Yeah, I think so. It's one further removed from that. The arguments against postmodernism and why people are willing to go and create very complex websites to mimic postmodernist critics and so forth and get very irate about postmodernism is that they themselves make very dramatic narratives of themselves. And of course, Baudrillard himself announced... let's see. This is the obituary for Baudrillard, published in The Guardian. John Baudrillard's death did not take place. Dying is pointless, he once wrote. You have to know how to disappear. So a man from the audience at the recent death of Jacques Derrida in mind mentioned obituaries and asked Baudrillard, "What would you like to be said about you? In other words, who are you?" Baudrillard replied, "What I am, I don't know. I am the simulacrum of myself." So, there he is, being a simulacrum of himself. So, okay. The other argument against is that it's not as simple as saying that there's only commodification. There is still a moral and emancipatory horizon somewhere. Someone is writing about good, bad. Think about ecological issues, the various conflicts that are actually taking place, and things that are happening in the Congo and so forth. There is actually still a horizon out there that's moral and emancipatory. We don't experience everything in the ways that are described by postmodern critics. Examples of many, as you've said, if not all, can be found in previous versions. Like the Frankfurt School, it betrays a judgment of popular culture, so it could be said to look down, you know, on popular culture and popular cultural events. And like all text-based studies, it fails to consider real audiences, users and players. There is very much the sense that if ultimately it's about commodification, that there isn't really a sense of who's consuming it built into the theories. They need to be added on afterwards. So that what you're actually seeing is this sense that there is an audience out there that is painfully manipulated by these sorts of... But actually people are maybe active and agentive in that. There's a community around things like... People are not being manipulated by the flight of the Conchords. They're choosing to go and view that. Word of mouth gets around. It's on HBO. It's at this time on a Tuesday night on BBC... four, and then it builds into DVD sales and so forth, and word of mouth and YouTube, and people are actively promoting this, and then they're making copies of things, and there's an active sense of cultural life around this. They're not being duped in some way. Go on. It's just simply the case that if for people to say it's a 20th century phenomenon, and that it's an example, because we have mass-produced culture now, and we make information and things to buy and sell in popular culture much more than we make artifacts, that the whole postmodern argument can only be built at the present time, in this stage of late capitalism, and that there aren't really any examples from history. But critics could make the case for almost any of those other things that are written there as being postmodern in some way. How would Robinson Crusoe be postmodern? Man, Friday, Island. Yeah. An island, yeah. There are all sorts of issues around this that you could say that Sherlock Holmes is a 20th century phenomenon, but people visit London looking for where Sherlock Holmes used to live and go for a drink, and there's a whole pub which is predicated on that called the Sherlock Holmes with a pipe in the case in the bar. Yeah. And it is partly to do with the fact that there's something of postmodernism in when people talk about this living life on screen, and that there's this blurring of the boundary between what's real and what's hyper-real. And there are cases that where it crosses the boundary into real life, such as, quoted in here, there's a famous example from a soap opera called Coronation Street a few years ago, where one of the characters was imprisoned, and her case was literally raised in the House of Commons by an MP. You know, the Free Deirdre Rashid campaign, which is a crime that she did not commit. But this is a television character. Some young people in the British electorate questioned on November the 4th really wanted to go after the interview to cast their votes for Barack Obama. But they were English, and they were 19, and they thought they could go to a polling station that evening to vote in the US election. Because they were caught up in it, and they were experiencing the reality of this fantastic event, that they were caught up in it and they wanted to go and put their vote down as well. Quite an amazing situation. A hyper-reality, if you like. But there are arguments against, and people would say, you know, people that are endlessly say... oh, I've lost that particular... Oh, I had another one to show. It doesn't matter. You've seen enough examples to know what I'm talking about now. Except to say that there is this hyper-reality machine, which is quite fun, where you can make your own Andy Warhol picture. And then when... this is quite fun. Search on hyper-reality. Actually, I'll put all these links up in Blackboard. And when you've made that, it will say, congratulations, you've just created an original soup can consisting of four copies of the original.